Hello, our tightrope family and friends. I'm Tricia Rose, and I'm here with my dear colleague and sage, insightful human being, Dr. Cornel West. And we're both really happy to see you here joining us for this special office hours. It's been a tough week for many people. It's been a tough year, but this last week with the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has really hit people pretty hard, and the consequences seem equally, if not more painful to swallow than the loss. So we wanted to check in with you, check in with each other, and think through this moment together. How are you doing, Cornel?
Well, it's a sad moment, there's no doubt. I mean, we live in very grim times, and yet things get grimmer and grimmer. And I hope that as they get grimmer, our spirits become more fortified. We become even more ready to tell the truth and fight for justice. And I think that's one of the great insights of our dear sister, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You know, she seemed to be like everybody else, but she's a product of that very rich and marvelous Jewish culture in the United States, out of the greatest borough in the world, Brooklyn, Flatbush, on through St. James Madison High School, that produced the same Bernie Sanders that I love and respect, produced Carole King, produced Chris Rock. But she was up against such vicious patriarchal bombardment. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Coming out of Cornell, Phi Beta Kappa, on the Harvard laws and transfers of Columbia law. Felix Frankfurter, the great progressive judge, you know, rejects her based on her gender. So even he, like anybody else, is subject to that kind of a critique, even over the Jewish brother Albert Sachs, who had recommended her. So even within the Jewish context, you got the vicious sexism going on. But I think the important thing is, in a moment of grimness, we want exemplars of courage and vision. And so when we look at her life, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Show up at Harvard Law, 9 out of 500 men, and the dean is saying, how come you're taking the position of a man? That's the first question she receives. You see what I mean? And so yet she persists, goes to Sweden, is deeply shaped by the feminist sensibility there. 25% of the people in law school are women, but yet you got 4 or 5% in the States. So she's encouraged by examples outside of the United States. So even in this grim moment, it's important for us to build on the tremendous contributions and courage that was exemplified by her and her brother Martin, her beloved husband and sister Jane and sister brother James, her kids. And yet, you know, here we are now with our dear sister gone.
Right.
And what do we do? How do we proceed? How do you read this moment, though, my sister?
Wow. Well, you know, why I love talking to you, I mean, there are many, many reasons, but one of them is that you find a way to keep our eye on the prize, right? That the exemplar, you know, example that she is very important to remember. I guess what happened to me when I heard about it, it was sort of in the context of just one more blow, right, for this fight that has gotten so gutter and so base and so crass and so dehumanizing. I mean, somehow her loss in that context felt more symbolic, you know what I mean, than necessarily just about the loss. I mean, we know she was an older woman, and she did more push-ups than I do, so I can't hate. She was in shape, right? But she could definitely do more push-ups. I'm not even kidding.
He could do more than that.
But at the same time, you know, the critical mind in me is wondering whether or not my own hope around her holding on, you know, kind of was a misplaced hope, right? In the sense that, you know, what are we to really expect, right? I mean, of course, it's been a grim time, as you said. It's grim, right? Upon grim upon grim. But at the same time, if you pay attention to constitutional and Supreme Court history, for Black people, just to name one group,
right.
It's always been a horror story. It's always been one foot forward, 5 feet back. The constant nuanced battles over the idea of whether or not we're human, over the idea of whether or not we're entitled to equal treatment. And then at every moment, one small step forward is then cut back, not only by other appointees, but by the whole political system and local political and social system. So, you know, so my first instinct was, you know, to be very, very sad. And then I started asking myself, well, what was I actually thinking? You know, I mean, really, I mean, if you know the history a little bit, and I'm no constitutional expert, but there's a lot to be not invested in. Let me put it that way. There's a lot to leave behind.
Absolutely. But I just think to myself, you know, what was going through her brilliant mind, her Phi Beta Kappa mind, Harvard Law Review and Columbia Law Review, both respective law schools. What was going through her mind when she emerges? You still got apartheid in the country for Black people. Mm-hmm. Women are completely marginalized, devalued, pushed to the periphery, laughed at if they are graduating at the top of their class, which she did at Columbia, but still couldn't get a job, you see. Mm-hmm. And you say, boy, that sounds grim too.
Right.
But how was she able to make that connection? The ACLU move that she made, the projects that she was a part of, the critiques of the vicious forms of sexism that she was willing to put mind, body, and soul to, and yet still remained in elite circles. And that's very important to keep in mind. She still remained very much in elite circles. Columbia Law and Harvard Law, you know, it's not
a bunch of everyday people.
Mississippi, that's exactly right. So you can be a freedom fighter in those contexts. And I think she exemplified that in her own way, and that's one of the reasons why we see this beautiful overflow of love for her. Mm-hmm. The morning that you see Harvard Law School, they got a huge show of flowers and things, and of course Supreme Court steps, they have the same thing. So we have to be able to sustain her spirit,
right,
and yet not fall into, like you say, the kind of false expectations, because the courts, but the Warren Court is really an exception when it comes to Black people and poor people and working people. It really is. Thank God there's been magnificent movements against the ugly forms of homophobia in the courts. And that's something, that's the kind of silver lining in the last 10 or 15 years. But generally speaking, you know, these courts are on the side of capital and big money. They're on the side of corporations, with citizens' case then gives corporations a right of individual persons to express themselves in terms of free speech. And so the big money flows into the electoral political system. All of those crucial issues,
right,
the courts tend not to be on the side of everyday people.
No. I mean, you know, that's such a good point you make about how one can be within the context of an elite institution of a powerful force for good. But one has to, doesn't, you know, occupying the space doesn't guarantee that. As we know, you know, say Brother Clarence Thomas being just an example of
that's
that.
That's exactly
but
right.
But it's important for people to see their own potential for, you know, massive transformational power inside of wherever they're located. But they should expect a battle. They should expect deep mistreatment. They should expect disrespect. They should expect, you know, marginalization and potentially loss of livelihood, right? Depending on
what
the options are going to be. So you're right. You're right to emphasize that. But we've been looking back in a way, right? Sort of,
yeah,
can the Supreme
right.
Court do something, you know, that's progressive in general? You know, is it an exception? Is it the rule? How amazing is, you know, the notorious RBG? But now I'm wondering also what you think about this next appointment. I mean, I've been just really stunned by the hypocrisy. Now, I know, again, I shouldn't be stunned, but I just keep expecting people to sort of respond in a kind of rationally logical, ethical way. Say, well, okay, well, if Cornell on Tuesday, I said you deserve two cups of coffee, you know, I can't say on Thursday you only deserve half a cup of coffee because that's a different day and I need more cups of coffee. I can't just change the rules up because I feel like changing the doggone.
Like that.
Yes,
that's
like,
right.
Am I going to benefit? That's one set of rules. Are you going to benefit? Right. That's another set of rules. And so I'm just so taken by this, you know, Mitch McConnell's vicious effort to prevent Obama from, you know, appointing a Supreme Court justice over 270 some odd days before the end of his term. Here we are a few weeks away, potentially, right, from the end of this president's term. And now we must appoint right away. I mean, how are you feeling about, how should people think about when they hear this such blatant disregard for an ethical response? What do you think people should do in the face of this?
I mean, one, you just tell the truth and you say, look, you know, Brother Mitch McConnell will go down as one of the most unprincipled Machiavellian politicians in American history. Mm-hmm. No consistency, no principles, little or no integrity, doing anything for raw power, doing anything to collaborate and accommodate himself to, in this case, actually neo-fascist gangster in the White House. Because the worst scenario is this is the next step on the way to American fascism. Right. That's really what we're talking about.
Right.
That's the worst scenario. The best scenario is trying to create some kind of countervailing force against that march, because it's not as if in the end the courts themselves or in and of themselves will ever be the bulwark against that move toward fascism. If the spirit of the people, if the loss of civic virtue in the people, if people's racism and sexism and hatred of others, of immigrants and so forth, cuts so deep, the courts can't do anything about it. America will still move in the fascist direction, you see. And so in that sense, I wouldn't want to fetishize the courts. I don't want to ascribe magical powers to them. There's a crucial role for them to play, but in the end, they don't play the ultimate role. Most courts accommodate to the spirit of the times.
Right.
People hit the streets, reshape the discourse. Next thing you know, our gay brothers and sisters, lesbian brothers and sisters got rights to get married. Who would have thought that 40 years ago?
25 years ago.
Exactly. I mean, even Obama himself didn't call for the federal law. We were putting pressure on Obama to make it a federal issue, to make it a constitutional issue at the highest level. Now, Biden, I give him credit for it. He was the one who pushed Obama in that regard. But that's just one example.
When it comes to
issues of poverty and these decrepit schools and the escalating xenophobia and so forth, the courts still tend to sit back too often. But when they do intervene, they can make a difference. They can make a difference.
But their equilibrium is on the hands and on the sides of the powerful. So they can make a difference.
That's a beautiful way of putting it.
You know, their equilibrium is on the side of the powerful, because they don't move to represent the people until the people daggone near tear the joint down.
That's right. But then they come in kicking and screaming.
They come in, wait, maybe, you know,
these black folk have been enslaved in Jim Crow for so long, so many of them are lynched. Maybe we ought to have the kids be able to sit next to each other just as an experiment, given the fact that they got some dolls out here and we got some evidence, and maybe they got a low self-esteem. Exactly. Thank you very much. Thank you so much.
That's so kind of you. It's so kind of you.
You allowed it. That's just like saying, we really do believe at this point that James Brown really is funky after all of these years.
We've done a big data analysis about the level of funk in every note.
13 years, we discovered that he got some funk with Maceo and company. Please, thank you so much. You know,
exactly. No, it's shocking. But you know, Mitch is, you know, out of control, and will go down in history as one of the worst. But look at all the people who've been lined up supporting that kind of position. You know, I mean, you have to remember, right? He's the, you know, head Machiavellian, but that doesn't mean he doesn't have an army, right? Because can't happen without an army. It's unbelievable how many people just don't mind this kind of behavior and are allowing it. So this makes me think about gangs in general. So I've been thinking.
Interesting. So,
you see, I knew you'd know just where I was thinking. You knew, like, boom, he's there. Cornell's there. I sort of gently signal I'm thinking about left. I look over, there he is. He's already there. So I've been thinking, you know, about the logic of, you know, retaliation, gang conflict and retaliation, and how difficult it is to stop it, right? Because once you basically have a dog-eat-dog mode, you don't know when your dog's getting eaten.
That's exactly right.
To eat somebody's dog all the time. And that's basically exactly where we are. So I'm like, no, do what we got to do. We got to do whatever it takes, right, in order not to let this happen.
That's exactly right.
So now, you know, all this language about the destruction of black communities and gangs are dangerous and they need to learn how to mediate. We need to tell this to the political system. Y'all go into mediation. Y'all need to basically have a truce and recognize that there's a public that's bigger and more important than you, and stop terrorizing the community, as in the entire world, not just the United States. Stop terrorizing the environment. Stop terrorizing trans people. Stop terrorizing poor people around the world. But I just think that it feels like we're locked in a gang, tit for tat, a gang situation. What do you think of that?
No, I think you're right. You know, Brother Martin used to say, eye for eye leaves all of us blind. Survival of the slickest means sooner or later, you're going to be done in by the slickest. And if everybody's obsessed with the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught, that nobody ends up running in the right direction. Everybody's running like a rat, and the winner of a rat race is still a rat. So you end up with a spiritual flatness, even in the very procedure and processes that we have. Now, we do have our two sisters, Collins and Murkowski, mm-hmm. Who are holding out. And looks like Brother Romney's holding out, too. Mm-hmm. They only need one more. But the fight, therefore, for Biden, and again, now, this just really, elevates the stakes. The fight for Biden now becomes even more relevant, even more intense, even more necessary, no matter how much one disagrees with him the way I do. It becomes very important as a bulwark, as a countervailing force against this march to American fascism, as I said.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, it don't even really matter what I think about Biden. I mean, it don't actually matter. He could do whatever he wants right now. He could say something ridiculous. I'd be like, okay, thanks very much. Just quiet down, brother. Just quiet down. Just quiet down. Let me vote for you, okay? Don't mess it up. I think this question of what investment should we have, what does it make sense to invest in? And what you always do, which I think is so important, is that you are examining the driving force of people's actions, not casting aspersions or supporting where they're making those actions. So whether or not it's in the Supreme Court, whether or not it's in the classroom, whether or not it's on the shop floor, whether or not it's in, financial industry in corporate America, or whether or not it's in the church, whether or not it's fill in the blank. So that's important, because it's easy to start demonizing whole institutions, because there's Manichaean, it's a battle against good and evil. So you're evil, I'm good, you're out. And that's where we are. But one of the ways we hold that at bay is by the kind of separation that you make between the moral arc of what people are doing versus where they're doing it.
You think of her friendship with Brother Scalia, who's about as right wing as you can get. He was a brilliant right wing legal mind. They were very close friends. He called her the Thurgood Marshall of woman rights when it comes to law. And that's no putting down. We're not trying to assimilate women's rights with black people's rights. All of those rights are precious and crucial, but it's clear Thurgood Marshall was a giant. Oh. She was a giant when it comes to women's rights and civil liberties. Mm-hmm. But in the end, I think more than anything else, given the spiritual decay that we're wrestling with, we've got to zero in on what went into the making of Joan Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You know what I mean? The virtues of courage and vision and determination. Where did she get it from? What was happening with Celia and Nathan, her parents? What was happening at that Jewish camp in Minerva, New York, that was giving her that sense of what she put on the wall in her office? Justice, justice thou shalt pursue, coming right out of Hebrew scripture of Deuteronomy. You can just hear Rabbi Heschel, Susanna Heschel. Don't forget, Sister Ruth, this is where you come from. You come from a great tradition that's concerned about integrity and honesty and justice and so forth. Mm-hmm. And that's what we need, the kind of fire she had. We've got to allow the afterlife of that fire to be in our lives if we're going to deal with this wrestling with America on the way to fascism.
You got that right. On that note, Dr. Cornel West, I'm going to have to close our office hours, because you shut it down with the thing we need to do most. Look at our traditions, figure out where we've come from. And if we don't come from it, find the tradition.
That's right.
If you can't identify it easily, go find one and become a part of it. That will be the bulwark against what we're up against right now. Well, it's so great to see you, Cornel. Thank you so much for sharing.
Always a blessing, my sister. You inspire so many of us.
Well,
you inspired myself and so many of us. Really.
Well, I appreciate you so much. Thank you so much. And everybody else, thank you for joining us on this Office Hour special edition. Hang on in there. I think we got a path forward that at least I'm going to follow based on this conversation. And we look forward to seeing you on the next full episode. And follow us on social media, like us or whatever they do on that social media. You know what I mean. All right. Good to see you. And we'll see you the next time on the Tightrope. Dear Tightrope family, we are joining Patreon. We're partnering with Patreon because they are empowering creators to maintain independence.
To preserve our independence of mind, to preserve our free spirits, and most importantly, to preserve our quest for truth.
By joining, you will gain access to special opportunities to engage with us as we share what we're reading, offer behind-the-scenes clips from our episodes, and ask you for your input around what we should focus on next.
Please be with us on this journey.
Together we can amplify truth, cultivate hope, and work to create a just world. Thank you and stay strong.